Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
Welcome to a brand new edition of Freedom, Books, Flowers and the Moon, the podcast brought to you each week by the Times Literary Supplement. My name is Stig Abel, the editor of the TLS. They said it could never happen, but yes, Thea and I are back together. Somehow not on holiday and enjoying this heatwave despite her rock star haircut is Thea Leonarduzzi. Thea, hello.
Hello.
Are you enjoying this hot weather?
I am still enjoying it, yeah.
It's not too much.
Well, I was in Italy at the weekend and it was much hotter there. It was 37.5 degrees at one point.
They can handle it, can't they?
Well, you say that, but we were working in the fields from 8 in the morning till 8 at night. We genuinely were.
Why were you doing that?
We were... It was my aunt and uncle's 25th wedding anniversary, so we were having a massive family party. That's 120 people, so we took delivery of tables, put them all out.
Oh, so you actually were working?
Oh, yeah, no, I was. I was gathering flowers in fields.
Oh, my
it was
God.
Intense.
It sounds a bit Bertolucci-y.
It was very much so, yeah.
Well, it was a good party?
Exhausting fun. Yeah.
And worth it in the end.
Yeah.
That's lovely, isn't it? Oh, we're going to talk to someone later on in Japan where it's even hotter. So there will be a theme running through this show. Make sure you are subscribing to this podcast and to the TLS, which really is a lovely paper and well worth reading. On this week's show, we're going to introduce you to someone claimed to be the greatest novelist of modern Japan. And it's not Murakami. Yes, it's Soseki, who was writing at the beginning of the 20th century, including the novel I Am a Cat. Eri Hotta has the details. Fancy a bit of LSD, anyone? The therapeutic benefits of psychedelics are now much in vogue. You might recall Lucy Dallas's interview with Michael Pollan on the subject in June this year on this very podcast. Well, Toby Lichtig has now reviewed an acid memoir and can tell us the current thinking. And we'll think about feminist publishing with the history of Virago. Has it blazed a trail and is there no longer much to worry about in terms of publishing phallocentrism? Kate Chisholm can tell us. I was always somewhat put off by the idea of LSD, its capacity to alter perception, to distort reality, to be a force of destabilising uncertainty. It seemed to me to be more terrifying than tempting. But LSD, as with some other drugs, seems to be staging a reputational rehabilitation. Galen Strawson this week reviews Michael Pollan's How to Change Your Mind, which offers an account of the science behind and his views of the benefits of this mind-expanding, mind-revealing drug. Of course, one challenge in any reconsideration is a linguistic and descriptive one. Psychedelic by now immediately conjures images of day-glow colours, grubby 60s self-indulgence, and hippie blather. And the search to describe the sensation of being high takes in all sorts of off-putting pseudo-religious waffle of the transcendent blissful variety. Strawson finds this as one conclusion in response. There's an extraordinary degree of agreement on the part of those who have successful trips under suitably controlled conditions that the fundamental principle of reality is love. Perhaps psychedelic drugs offer no more than a version of that great post-Edenic ideal, a return to innocence, to the unfiltered pleasures of youth. Children, according to one theory, are basically tripping all the time. It's only inhibited adults that have need of artificial assistance to try. One such adult is the novelist Tao Lin, whose book Trip is reviewed by our fiction editor Toby Lichtig this week. The latter notes that we now live in a golden age of illegal drug taking. The London Times even ran an article recently with this chintzy headline, "Is LSD the new middle class dinner party treat?" Sounds awful. Lynn is apparently strong on the legal mess of drug prevention, but less appealing when his gaze turns inward. As Toby says, drug experience is so particular and in the moment that, much like sex, it's hard to write about well. The problem with those who proselytise about the benefits of drugs is not their roguish attraction, but their entitled solipsism. If we are to reconsider first principles about psychedelics and drugs more generally, there's perhaps work to be done in the realms of language and artistry, as well as science. Well, to talk about all that, Toby's here in the studio, looking fairly blissed out.
Peace and love.
Peace and love. cards on the table then, everyone. Who wants to share their experiences with LSD to kick us off? Thea.
So gentle.
Yeah, no, well.
No, after you.
Yeah. I've never had it. I'm scared of it. I'm genuinely scared of it. I find this whole issue fascinating because the notion of being out of control in my mind is so terrifying. I always look to LSD as madness, you know, connecting it with madness and not just bad trips, just the idea of being so lacking in control it could cause damage.
The idea of seeing things that aren't perhaps there.
Yeah.
Or of discovering things in the depths of your own soul that are there, the darknesses or something. Yeah, I mean,
Without being rationally controlled.
Yeah, same as you. Well, people talk about, I know hallucinations are a very small part, they're not that common, but talk about seeing people who have died and confronting them and things like that, which petrifies me even though... There's no one, you know, who's died who I would, you know, I think it would mess with my mind.
And the idea of not being able to get back, Toby, I always find that about it. It feels like it has the power to change things. And therefore you could...
My sense is that's entirely overinflated though, and there have been various scare stories over the year to, you know, trips that you never come back from or whatever.
Yeah.
And the average trip tends to last about 12 hours, which is a commitment.
But the afterglow can last for 6 weeks.
The afterglow can, yeah. But also, you know, I guess like a session of psychotherapy, the things that it brings up may last for a very long time.
Yeah, but I don't want to be out of control for 12 hours ever, I don't think.
But
is it out of control?
I wouldn't necessarily say it's out of control. I mean, for my own experience, it's to do with detail. A lot of it's to do with detail, seeing things that you wouldn't necessarily notice in your normal life because you're too busy thinking about all the other things and you're too ego led. So whether it's, you know, on a very basic level, appreciating music in a certain way because you're just completely plugged into it, or art, or really confronting some of the very difficult things about existence, like people you may have lost and your own mortality.
This all has to do with the set and setting thing. That's something that people say again and again.
Absolutely.
When discussing LSD.
Absolutely. So yes, the idea that it's a middle class dinner party drug seems quite bizarre and vile to me in many ways as well, because you know, you wouldn't want to sit around with 15 people eating chicken talking about Brexit. No.
it's not too much.
It's definitely something you want to do.
It's Brexit on LSD.
There are sort of the two channels. One, obviously, scientifically, if we're talking about psychotherapy or psychiatry, yes, you want to be guided by people who are, you know, medical practitioners and who know what they're doing. But also, if you're doing it in a more recreational way, and I think recreational is possibly the wrong word because it conjures up ideas of hedonism, whereas in fact, when it comes to mood enhancement and experience, it's not necessarily just about, you know, having fun. But you definitely want to do that with someone who has done it before, knows what they're doing, and can guide you, really.
Compared with something like taking peyote or something like that, you would normally have someone who is, you know, almost like a shaman who accompanies you through the thing. But people don't really talk about that when they talk about LSD. They don't really talk about it.
They don't, and perhaps, you know, perhaps they should, and perhaps, you know, again, it's something that's been very much out of the popular consciousness for a while, apart from jokes about tie-dye and, you know, look, that's the 60s or whatever. But perhaps
if it does have that cultural baggage, that's unquestionably, as you say, LSD.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
I think of drifters in San Francisco who took one trip in 1969 and never came back.
But that is largely to do with the war on drugs, which sort of began in the late 60s and which stigmatised particularly acid. Which, you know, was deemed extremely fearful by Nixon and the establishment, and there have been so many scare stories about acid that aren't necessarily based in fact. I'm not saying that people have never had a bad trip, and I'm not saying that, you know, there are lots of studies to show there is no link between psychosis and LSD use. That's also debatable. I'm sure it's possible to prove that schizophrenia has been brought on by it in certain cases. That's hard to tell, you know, whether it would have happened anyway. So I'm not saying LSD is never bad for you or that everyone should take it or whatever, but the scare stories have been overinflated, and that correlated with that kind of 60s hippie culture has given it a very bad reputation.
There's that great statistic you gave, which is the drug harm score.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Which I'd never heard of. Can you explain what that is?
Yeah, so there, I don't exactly know exactly on which metrics they base
how
it
how
on.
They do.
Exactly
you,
how they
you
do.
You've got the number. I've got the numbers,
yeah. It's the Independent Scientific Committee on Drugs. They gave LSD a harm score of 7 out of 100, 100 being very bad and 0 being absolutely fine. By the same measures, alcohol score 72. And one of the things about LSD is it's essentially non-toxic. It doesn't have any impact on your cardiovascular system. So a drug, you know, forget heroin or whatever, but a drug like ecstasy, which, you know, really does set your heart rate going and can induce various physical symptoms, LSD doesn't really have an effect on the body. Now, yes, it may or may not cause bad mental effects in certain people, but it's basically not non-harmful. And there's an argument that no one has ever died.
And it's non-addictive.
And it's completely non-addictive. I mean, I think Michael Pollan said in the podcast with Lucy a few weeks ago, he said, you know, when you come out of a sort of 12-hour acid trip, your first thought is not, when can I do this again, but do I ever have to do this again?
Really?
Yeah.
So what are we envisaging? I think that'd be useful to know that the increasing respectable nature of LSD seems to be an accepted fact. What is the end game here? Is it that this should be used recreationally and legally, or is it that actually it should be used by therapists as a tool to enable people with various mental health issues to seek help?
In short, both. I think the most important thing is the scientific aspect of it, because it really does seem to have a fantastic effect on anxiety and depression.
This idea of love, it was interesting that the one relic of the 60s cliche, Summer of Love, is still there.
Yeah,
it's the outcome is love.
Yeah, absolutely. And so whether it's the kind of that sense of love and sort of oneness with the world and acceptance that people in the throes of terminal illness can feel when given LSD during therapy, or more recreationally, a sense of oneness with the world and fellow feeling. I think both are very, very valid. I mean, the scientific aspect is more important to humanity. I mean, we're living in, it's a cliche, but we're living in the middle of a mental health epidemic. You know, levels of depression are soaring, levels of suicide are soaring in the Western world.
And we also recognise mental health issues.
And recognise it, yeah,
so the reporting has gone up.
The reporting has gone up, absolutely. But there, you know, there is, exactly, there's a recognised problem, and antidepressants don't seem to be adequately dealing with it. And if it proves to be the case that LSD can help, then great. Secondly, on a more recreational level, I think when taken in the right conditions and sensibly, it can be a very, very life-affirming and, you know, perception-opening thing.
On the medical side of things, so it's interesting because that this is how it started. It started obviously in labs with people looking to solve things, to isolate what it is that LSD can do.
Absolutely,
for us
after
to make
it was
life better.
After it was accidentally discovered, absolutely.
Yeah. And then obviously it was stopped. They stopped the research into that. And you were saying about the war on drugs. It's interesting how people were on side. The media was on side for so long, I think. Time magazine, I think,
yeah,
really turned against
it. Was sort of in 1965 or something.
1965 or something like, yeah, that. Before that, they were really supportive of its of us exploring how it could help us medically. Why has it taken so long for it to come back round?
It's a very good question. I think the war on drugs was extremely effective, is a short answer.
Well, it must have worked theoretically as well. It's only now, really, that the war on drugs has failed year after year after year after year.
Yeah.
So at some point,
but financially, there's so much more at stake now because Big Pharma are you know, have all of these drugs that are supposed to help us fight depression,
which aren't working.
But
and I think there are two reasons for its rehabilitation. One, which is the sort of the bigger one and the kind of more slow burning one, has been that since the 90s, and Michael Pollan talks about this in his book, there were a group of researchers who basically took it upon themselves to rehabilitate it and start using it more in trials. I think, you know, there were maybe only 20 or 30 of them. They just decided to jump, you know, to rehabilitate it, and that gained traction gradually. And there was this big conference in 2008 to celebrate the centenary of Alfred Hoffman, who discovered LSD, and he was still alive at the time. And that also helped bring about a renewed scientific interest.
And
then
he apparently was taking it for the last decades of his life.
He microdosed in his 90s.
Why does microdosing work? Is that's not homeopathy idea that you have such small amounts no one can realise why it does stuff?
No, and I don't know how well it has been researched scientifically, but it does really seem to have a benefit as an antidepressant if you take these tiny amounts sort of every 2 or 3 days.
It's the hangover here, because I often talk about drug legalization, and it seems to me that my starting point is that it's not morally wrong
for people to want to get high. And it seems for LSD to be rehabilitated, that argument has to be accepted. Because at the minute, every time you mention drugs, there is this very conservative small c reaction, which is, it must be bad because it's somehow wrong.
That's just simply not a viewpoint that I subscribe to.
But no, it's interesting that is an embedded cultural viewpoint, isn't it?
Absolutely. But, you know, we're massive hypocrites. You know, we've decided that alcohol's fine and we've decided that, you know...
Smoking cigarettes
is fine and various other things that are clearly bad for you. Yeah, well, also harmful are fine.
Because we say that they're not... I mean, they exist and they're legal, but we don't think they're fine.
Okay, well, then, you know, maybe there's a continuum, but we're definitely hypocrites about it. I mean, yeah. The same people who might brag about their alcohol consumption will think that acid is a terrible thing for you. But then, so, along with the scientific research, you've got the dark web, which I talk about in my piece, the dark net. And it's made acid, for example, a lot easier to buy. I mean, I don't know, when I was growing up, you could get acid in school, perhaps, and whatever, but it was never a very good street drug. It doesn't really sell very well, you know. As we said, it's non-addictive. It's very cheap, incredibly cheap. You don't come back for loads of it, so what's the point in selling it? But so it wasn't particularly easy to get hold of. But because you can get hold of anything on the dark net...
But is the stuff that you buy there, do we know that that's safe, you know, in inverted commas? Can it be cut with things in the same way as... other drugs can be cut with it.
I mean, technically, yes, but I don't know how you would particularly cut a tab with anything, because it's just a big blotter soaked in water, and it's either the thing itself or not really. I mean, it's so cheap.
You could soak it in something
you
else.
You could, but it's... Well, you could soak it in something else, but it's not really about cutting. The reason why you cut cocaine is cocaine is expensive.
No, I mean,
and therefore
lacing.
Lacing, yeah, yes, absolutely. But one of the joys of, of the dark net, and there aren't very many of them, because it's obviously a very, very nasty place where you can get hold of some very nasty things as well, is that it's customer reviewed. So if you're a drugs vendor who's selling stuff that's either terrible or doesn't have any effect or whatever, you quickly go out of business.
So very quick in a minute about the book, actually. We've not mentioned that you've read. I like the interest in how you write about drugs, but there's a great headline in the Times this morning about the respectability of drugs now. In Colorado, there is a correlation between cannabis usage and house prices going up. So cannabis usage is higher in areas with higher house prices. So if anything's going to convince the Daily Mail
that cannabis is okay, then that's
the thing. It feels like there is a bit of a global progress here, because you're starting to get this idea, well, it's legal in cannabis, to take an example, it's legal now in California. It's legal either for medical purposes or recreational in more states than it's illegal. Yeah. There does feel like there's a bit of a force, doesn't there?
Absolutely. And there's Portugal, for example, which is not just about cannabis use, but various drugs. Pretty much decriminalise everything. That's been very successful.
Let's talk about Trip.
Yes.
Because how hard is it to write well about drugs, do you think?
Pretty hard.
This guy doesn't do it.
No. Why is that? He's an interesting writer, Tao Lin, and I've been a bit harsh about him in the piece, I think fairly. But his fiction's actually excellent, and he's very... His previous book, his previous novel at least, Taipei, is full of these disaffected, drug-addled characters who he pokes fun at, allows us to empathise with as well. But he's got that kind of authorial distance, and that's why it really works. This is all about him. When it's not all about him, the book's actually very good. When he talks about various LSD proselytizers, Terence McKenna's one of them, he's interesting. When he talks about the war on drugs, he's very interesting. He's a very clear, lucid writer. When he talks about his own experiences, he does just seem pretty narcissistic.
And is that the problem with drugs? Like you parallel with sex, I thought, was a great parallel, because it's sex, everyone's kind of experienced it, but it's very self-centred.
It's very self-centred, and it's very in the moment as well. You know, it's not necessarily linguistically based. I mean, yes, of course, you can describe things that aren't linguistically
based. But it becomes silly very easily.
Exactly. And it's just occurred to me, there's this bit in Trip where he gets high, I can't remember if it's DMT or LSD, and he decides that he doesn't need his worldly goods, and he gets rid of his laptop. And then he comes to a few hours later and decides, of course, he needs his laptop, and he goes and buys another one. And it's kind of funny. That's quite a funny idea. But he writes about it in such an affectless way that he just sounds a bit spoiled. And it doesn't... It sounds silly.
And the narcissism sounds a bit ironic, given that a big point of LSD and other psychedelics is to obliterate the ego.
Yeah. Exactly.
But if you read anyone writing about it, because the other is not being affectless, it's to be too affected. So you end up with that sort of Norman Mailer when he was writing... under the influence of drugs and about drugs, where you sort of roll lots of words together and you write spacily to try and convey spaciness, and it's
absolutely
just kind of,
yeah. I think the tale is a kind of affected affectlessness, if that makes any sense. But yeah, you're absolutely right, Theo. It's very interesting, the idea that the LSD is all about dissolving the ego, and writing is quite an egocentric thing. So how do you
true that?
How do you write about dissolving the ego? I don't know. It has been done well.
Does anyone do it well? Who Chris got to go, but who writes well about drugs?
You've got to have naked lunch.
I mean, yeah, William Burroughs is obviously, yeah. You know, boringly enough, we're talking about acid. Huxley and Timothy Leary do write well about it.
Trust Thompson?
I think
Hubert Selby Jr.
Yeah.
These are all sort of rite of passage drugs you read.
Yeah, they all are. We've all read them.
The one that I read fairly recently, because I've only just caught up with the Edward St. Auburn quintet, is the second one in that Bad News, which is just, the whole novel is just a set piece drug spender. And it talks about, I mean, that's not about the joys of acid, that's about the absolute horrors, the narcissistic horrors of consumption, uppers and downers and regulating mood. But it's brilliant. One other book I'd quickly like to point out is this Russian book called Novel with Cocaine by a pseudonymous author called M. Gaev. I think it was written in the late 1919, something like that. And it's brilliant, and it's very good on compulsion.
Oh, fantastic. This podcast is going to be full of... We've got I Am a Cat coming, and then we've got this. That's brilliant.
Go.
Great recommendations. Toby Lichtig, thank you very much indeed. Born in 1867 as Natsume Kinosuke, the writer who became known as Soseki was sent to London at the turn of the century as Japan's first Japanese literary scholar. He wasn't entirely happy over here, later calling his two-year stay the most miserable time of my life. But when he returned, he published to acclaim two novels in 1905, Botchan and I Am a Cat, the first of 15 he was to write. His career led him to become one of Japan's key national writers, his face adorning the 1,000 yen note until 2004. This week, Eri Hotta has reviewed John Nathan's biography of Soseki, which calls him modern Japan's greatest novelist. A large claim indeed, but does it stack up? Eri is on the line to tell us. Eri, hello.
Hello.
Let's start with the subtitle. How far can you go along with the idea of Soseki as the greatest in modern Japan?
I think he's certainly one of the greatest. As far as my personal taste is concerned, I think he really is the greatest in modern literature. I think he really embodied the kind of the pressure for modernization and westernization while sort of retaining a very Japanese character. He also tried to theorize literature in a way that nobody really in the world had done. So he was quite unique in that as well. And he was a Renaissance man. He, you know, wrote poetry, haiku poetry. He did calligraphy. He was well-versed in several different languages, including classical Chinese. I think he references quite a lot. And, you know, as a reader, I don't think I can appreciate him with the appreciation that he really deserves. But even then, I think he's just so enjoyable and pleasurable. He's a pleasure to read, really. I mean, I saw someone on the train today reading Soseki.
Oh, really?
Yes, so he's very much alive in daily life in Tokyo.
So what makes his novels so pleasurable to read, then?
Actually, his biographer, John Nathan, whose book I reviewed, he actually emphasizes on the darker side of his
Yeah, he calls
character.
Him grim, doesn't he?
Yes, and it's true that, you know, he, you know, actually says that it's not possible to really understand other people. There's no sort of, it's not possible to really have an understanding, real understanding, and let alone love. But I think in the end, I think he kind of laughs at it, and he just kind of sees life as kind of a comedy. And people who struggle even and, you know, cries over different things, I think he's very good at making fun of people, making fun of himself, that in the end, it's the kind of sense of humor and lightheartedness about everything that's so pleasurable.
Is it useful for us to reference Dickens? Because there's a couple of things that make me think about. He wrote serially for newspapers, and you talk about his childhood being very formative for him in a kind of Dickensian fashion.
Yes, he was born to a fairly well-off, although declining family of a hereditary magistrate in Edo, which is now Tokyo. So he was quite lucky in that, but he was also the seventh of the children. So the parents were kind of embarrassed about him, you know, having him at old age and also having too many children. So he was put up for adoption several times before he was returned finally to the original family. So that's Dickensian. He was also pockmarked. So physical scar that he endured was quite great. So I think he had many complexes about growing up, not necessarily to a poor family, but to people who didn't really appreciate him.
And so presumably this humour, this self-deprecating humour that you mentioned, was part of his way of coping with all of that.
Yeah, I think that was the only way probably to deal with it. And even in the darkest days that you talked about in London, where he locked himself up and tried to theorise about literature, you know, he was really willing to try everything. He tried bicycling and he really tried sort of, you know, conversing with Christian ladies as well. So I think he really, I mean, despite his misanthropic sort of nature or kind of theme that you encounter in his books, I think he really liked to be engaged with communities, and you know, he liked, you know, being surrounded by people.
I love this idea that he should come to England and be told to cycle to cure his depression. Just jump on a bike.
That would happen now, I think. Before we leave him in London, do tell us about his flatmate Ikeda, who, because that's quite a confluence of greatness, isn't it? In one flat in Clapham,
it is,
I think.
It is. His flatmate in the first year was called Kikuna Ikeda, who is a chemist who studied in Leipzig, and he was on his way home via London, and he shared a flat with Soseki for several months, and they engaged in quite a lot of topics, discussing about Zen philosophy and aesthetics and education and so forth. He himself is a Renaissance man of sorts, so it was a kind of meeting of minds. But Ikeda is actually the man who discovered the taste property of umami, which is deliciousness. Is umami really an English word now?
Yeah, it is.
Umami means deliciousness or essence of taste.
Yeah, to foodies like Thea, umami is constantly, she never stops talking about umami.
That's right. So it's not salty, it's not sweet, it's not sour, it's not bitter, it's just delicious. But taken too much, you get sick. Basically, it's monosodium glutamate. I mean, people accused of Chinese food of being too much monosodium glutamate, and it was considered something bad, but it's actually naturally occurring property. Ikeda, the chemist, actually extracted it from kelp and anchovies and sugarcane, so it's actually organic.
And he had an idea, Ikeda, which is relevant to Soseki, which is that you've got to find a way of getting good, tasty stuff to as wide a range of people. And Soseki, writing in a good-selling newspaper, was trying to do the same thing with his literature, do you think?
Absolutely. That's just my theory, but I think they really had a sort of meeting of minds there, that they wanted to make available, you know, tasty things in life. And to Soseki, I think literature was something that should be tasty to many people, delicious to many people. Even the heartaches and sorrows and tears, it could be savored and it could be laughed at even in the end if you kind of make a comedy out of it. So Kikuna Ikeda actually made a product out of this deliciousness called Ajinomoto, which is MSG. And he was quite successful until he got kind of maligned in the 70s when people started accusing it of being kind of too chemical and too, synthetic.
Talking about the kind of the chemical synthesis of things, there's something similar going on, it sounds like, in Soseki's own writing. John Nathan describes his writing as synthesizing Japanese sensibilities and Western approaches to the novel. I'm wondering if you can tell us what elements of each we would find in his work. What is it about the sensibilities that makes him particularly Japanese, and what are the approaches that are particularly Western?
I think his approach to kind of dissecting everything and analyzing, that was probably a very Western technique. But what he describes in his novels are quite Japanese, everyday life, quotidian life, people kind of disguising their feelings. But underneath, feelings are simmering and No, they had always been there, I'm sure, but I think Soseki discovered tools and kind of analytical language to express them in a way that nobody in Japan had done before.
What novels should we go off and read? Because he wrote 15, I think, and I'm sure quite a few of our listeners won't have heard very much about him. If we had to go and read a couple of books, novels by Soseki, what would you recommend and what would they be about?
I don't know. I value him as an essayist as well, so there are quite a lot of great essays and speeches that he gave. But if I were to pick one to just start, maybe I Am a Cat.
I was hoping you were going to say that. Explain that to us.
Is I Am a Cat is a kind of a Swiftian satire. It's a story of a professor, a pompous professor, whose domesticated cat actually describes the sort of daily life of his owner. The professor is heavily modeled on Soseki himself. So it kind of shows him at his best, kind of making fun of himself. And also, I think the London years, of course, were quite essential because that really forced him to look at himself from a kind of distant perspective and kind of made him look at his own idiosyncrasies and pomposities. And one of the kind of first novels that he wrote and also one of the finest that he wrote.
Well, I think that I hope that if this podcast does nothing else, people will be heading out to pick up I Am a Cat by Soseki. Erihotta, thank you so much for telling us all about him.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.
Thank you. We had a piece there saying that Japanese fiction should be classed as before Murakami and after Murakami.
I saw that, yeah.
I wonder how you'd think Japan is a very old culture. It's a very proud culture. It doesn't feel that in literary terms it's that well known over here, the great writers. I read the Penguin Book of Short Story Writers relatively recently and there was stuff I'd vaguely heard of, but not that much. And then there's Murakami and you think, well, yes, but outside of that, do you think we undervalue it? I mean, I don't know if I've read enough to make the judgment.
Yeah, I don't know. I would say I haven't either.
Which is interesting. Why have we not?
Well, I mean, it's a relatively small country, I suppose, and until late 1860s, it didn't really have a national literature. It was kind of classical Chinese, wasn't it? And then the Edo period ended, which I think was basically the same year as Soseki was born.
Yeah,
marked the end of the Edo period. And then, as far as I know, it was only really after that that you started to have this national literature forming. And so, well, we were talking about it earlier, weren't we? Sort of trying to list the Japanese writers we do know. And Murakami was obviously there. And then Katsuo Ishiguro, who is, he left Japan when he was 5. And so his formation, his education has been very British. And then I can name a modernist poet
which
for you.
Which I thought
you
was cool. Go on, name
Sakutaru
them.
Hagiwara. Well done. And not really much else, but...
I read, this is not very helpful, but I did read, I read Jay Rubin's translated... The Penguin have put out a book of Japanese short stories, which Jay Rubin has translated, Murakami's introduced, and I read it. And there's one story in it, which I can't remember who it's by, but people have to Google it and find out. And it's about a man and a woman, and the man feels that he's let his comrades have let him down. And his honour has been besmirched. And he's very happily married to his wife. And he goes home and they decide they're both going to commit seppuku.
Okay, so immediately we're thinking of Mishima here.
And and then it describes over a period of about 20 pages the ritual before it. And commit seppuku.
Yeah.
And the feel of...
the disembowelment.
The disembowelment. And of course it is Mishima, because it is Mishima, isn't it? Because he went on to do it himself.
Yeah.
But that short story is well worth tracking down if you've not read it. It's absolutely, because it's played so straight. And the kind of, at one level, it's a love story between two people who care about each other a lot. And another, it's a very weird, ritualised decision to commit.
Yeah, I remember seppuku. When I first heard someone told me about Yukio Mishima's seppuku, or harikiri.
Yeah.
And it completely fascinated me because it was the first I'd heard. And it's just such a strange and...
It's a great
hard-hitting cultural.
Have you read the story?
No, I haven't.
Oh, read the story. It blew me. I couldn't stop thinking about it. It's one of those.
Yeah,
things
I mean that's
that...
what I mean. It really gets into your head, this idea of ritual disembowelment, because you feel you have to atone for your guilt and your disloyalty or something.
It's crazy. But listen, let's all, as a result of this podcast, go and read some Japanese fiction.
Deal. In recent years, there's been a much talked about rebirth in small independent publishing, a supposed backlash against the increasingly corporate mass of consecutively merged publishing houses. These new outfits have intriguing names that tell us something about their ethos. Fitzcarraldo, Le Fugitive, Jacaranda, for example. They have a tight focus, mission statements, to raise the bar of literature or to give a voice to the outsider, whether made so by gender or skin colour. A distinctive physical design is crucial, specific colours, formats, fonts and so on. Something to make the titles stand out and cohere. I suspect that most of these relative newcomers would happily recognise Virago, founded in 1973 by Marcia Rowe, Rosie Boycott and Carmen Khalil, as a forerunner in all of this. Virago books are instantly recognisable, especially, no doubt, to female readers, who covet the dark green spines emblazoned with that provocative bitten apple logo that might denote a book by Angela Carter or Rebecca West or Muriel Spark. The modern classic series to which those writers belong was conceived to, as Kate Chisholm puts it in a review this week marking 40 years of modern classics, to challenge the established male-dominated literary canon and rescue and rehabilitate forgotten works by women. After all, Virago was established to counter the male-operated machine of mainstream publishing and called itself a feminist press. Making the house a commercial success was, Carmen Khalil said, a feminist intervention. Interesting, then, that the word feminist has now been dropped, and that the house has only really been independent for 13 years of its 45-year history. But that's all part of the checkered Virago story, which Kate is here to discuss with us now. Kate, let's start at the beginning with the conception of Virago. What was the context of its founding? How was it greeted by the wider establishment at the time?
It's hard to think back to feminism at that time, but it was very much Greenham Common, dungarees, bra burning, and sort of marches about the pill and abortion and things like that. So feminism was seen by, shall we say, the male-dominated literary world, which it was then. It's hard to conceive how male-dominated it would have been at that time. It was at that time. So it was greeted with suspicion by those people, but by readers like myself, it was like, wow, this is what we need to have.
Was it seen as a commercial opportunity by other people? Because this must have been more than 50% of the market is female. Was this seen as there's a scope here for this to be commercially a big deal, trying to actually focus on the needs of half of the market rather than not think about it at all?
I suppose to that I would say that they did see it as commercial, because although it's just half the market, I don't know the statistics, but certainly I would say that women were much more likely to read novels at that time.
I think that's still true now. Yeah. I think they always have been a bigger chunk of the market.
Mm. And I think particularly at that time, because of course there weren't other distractions.
Yeah, no.
I read a lot at that time. And didn't watch much TV, didn't have a TV.
So was it initially very successful? I mean, how successful was it when it launched? Were these big numbers?
It was immediately successful, the classics series. The books that they were publishing, like Mary Chamberlain's book, Fen Women, and then the Sheila Rowbotoms, the Elaine Showalters, and those sort of books.
Which were about feminism.
A literature of their own was the big one, wasn't
yes,
it?
Yes.
Everyone remembers reading, I think.
Yeah.
All women will remember reading that if they studied English.
Who writes for the TLS
yes,
still?
Yes, exactly,
amazing,
yes.
Brilliant
writer. Virago was always more successful than any of the others. That's what's quite interesting about it, and I didn't realise until I read this book quite how it was the model in which it was based. It always had, nearly always, it was a very short period, only 13 years as you mentioned, where it was actually independent. The rest of the time it had backing, and it started off, I didn't realise this, but backed by Quartet Books of Naima Tala. So it always had a very strong commercial basis and always was therefore more successful than the others, and is the one that has survived. It got a lot of criticism because it wasn't therefore, if you like, strictly following feminist lines by allowing itself to have women, men on the board and sort of men making decisions.
And that sort of gets to the heart of the Virago problem in a sense, the reason why some people love it and some people would rather it be criticised more for that. It sort of intersects with that old feminist question of whether you beat them by playing the game to their rules, by following their rules, or whether you play a completely different game.
Yes.
And it seems like Virago did the former.
Yes, I think that's what came out strongly in Catherine Riley's book, what I found so fascinating, because I didn't really know this backstory at all. I just knew reading the books. Every woman will have encountered that dilemma, in a sense, within their working life, actually.
And what do you think? I mean, presumably it's better that it succeeds and produces something than gets locked into an internal row about principles. Far better to be pragmatically out in the world.
Yeah, I think overall I would say that. I think probably where I would really agree with Karma Khalil, was always was the literary worth. So she wasn't going to publish anything unless it was a good book.
Yeah.
And that was the thing that mattered, would matter, and to me would be the principle upon which I would stick. So I would not be happy publishing a book that was by a woman if it wasn't well done.
And it's now part of the zeitgeist. Presumably, there's never been more zeitgeisty than it is now. I mean, with issues of feminism higher on the agenda potentially than they've otherwise been, female representation and that sort of thing.
I would say that we are living, we've gone backwards.
Really?
I would seriously say we've gone backwards. I think it's a sort of contradictory in the sense that, yes, you've got far more women in positions of power within publishing. There was one point where the four of the big chiefs were all women. I don't think that's true anymore because some of them have moved away. But actually perceptions of women, how women are portrayed in advertising and in lots of ways, I think that a lot of what I grew up thinking we must have or be appalled by, representations of women have gone back a lot.
Really?
Yes, I do. Since when I was young.
In literature or in publishing?
More generally.
More generally.
Yeah.
In literature, yeah, actually, some of the sort of male novelists, if you like, that I think they are still portraying women in a really sort of archaic way, really.
Would you name names there? Would you?
But for instance, on Chesil Peach, I think is based on a premise which is entirely false and is entirely
okay. This is in McEwan's novel about a 1960s
yes.
failed marital which, night.
Yes. Just made into a film.
Yeah, just made into a film. I just think it's based on an entirely false view of women, which is sort of almost comes out of that period of the late 60s, early 70s, when men were quite defensive because women were really quite on the streets. And that's how it reads.
Do you think the literary world is still as male-dominated as it ever was?
I don't think it is, actually, no.
We have a sort of 50-50 policy at the TLS.
Yes, because in the book she talks about the whole review debate and how just as recently, just a few years ago, the TLS, was it 18% of reviews were by women as opposed to men? And actually, you start really scrutinising current issues and you realise that that balance has... There is a big change going on now because I think women sort of in their sort of 30s are very different. The women are much more confident and are in big jobs, and I think things are changing in that sense. But in sort of media representations of women, it's almost like the whole virgin whore sort of dichotomy has almost got more fixed and more...
Do you feel that, Thea, when you consume media?
I don't know. It's difficult to say.
You won't be able to know whether it's got worse because you weren't there
exactly,
before. But do you feel it's a presence?
And also, I remember I've come from a different country with a very different culture when it comes to women. Coming from Italy to here, that represents a massive shift.
What, is it more deferential in Italy?
No, things are much worse in Italy.
And maybe if things are changing in terms of representation, in terms of more powerful younger women, there'll be a lag, but those decision makers will change things perhaps in the next five. You know, Wonder Woman, you know, the fact that there was the first film directed by a woman that made more than $800 million, the fact that, you know, in lots of broad Avengers-style comic book representations, there are more female characters, there are more...
And yet they are always very good-looking.
Yes.
Yeah, well, that's possibly true of men in...
No, but
you
still, in films and in other media, it's still, you're still much more likely to see a not-so-attractive man being successful.
Yeah, that's probably true.
Yes, and, you know, you've still got this whole sort of red carpet.
That's been questioned more, I guess, whether successfully or not, at least in the ether.
Yes.
It seems a person making a very baldly sexist statement or programme or something would not go unchallenged now in a way that, say, even in the 90s, with the rise of lad mags, for example, you couldn't imagine a rise of lad mags now passing effectively without broad challenge. So that must...
I guess the problem is that now you've had the whole swing back, so now you would be more likely to see a mag that is doing what men's mags did to women, to men. You know, that kind of...
Ironic
objectification, and I just don't see that anyone's winning out of that.
I think that's exactly what I would... Yes, and it kind of ends up with that whole sort of... the same kind of battle, if you like, going
exactly.
on. And it's sort of displaced, but it's equally damaging to both.
And no one's winning.
No one's winning.
And we're all losing, actually,
yes.
out of it.
Yeah.
How lovely.
Joy, oh joy.
Well, Kate, it's a downbeat ending, but it's a fascinating subject. Thank you so much
for
coming in.
Thank you.
That's all we have time for, alas. Our thanks to Eri Hotter, Kate Chisholm and Toby Lishtig. Do make sure you're subscribing to the paper. This week we have a special section on the Pacific region, covering Indonesia, the Philippines and even West Coast American hippie anthropology. Next week we'll be talking film, so join us for that. Until then, from Thea and from me, goodbye.